This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Hover. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it, you want something catchy and memorable, Hover gives you exactly what you need to find the perfect domain for your idea. Joanna, today the code that we are going to tell people is hover.com/cat. It's hover.com/cat. You can get 10% off your order if you use that promo code. You chose these promo codes in advance, at the beginning of the season, and you can just kind of guess, season 7, hover.com/cat's probably going to make sense. Where was cat referred to this week at all? Like, what's going on here? Is this a spoiler that you've given away in the code, or, like, what's going on?
It's not a spoiler, but what I will say is that Game of Thrones does a thing where we have the title of the episode, right? That's what I was going off of, which is The Gift, which turned out to be Tyrion. But I'll say that there's like three other things The Gift could have referred to.
Uh-huh.
And what I thought it was referring to was something that would make sense along with the word cat. But it did not. How I wish I had picked the word egg, which I picked a couple weeks ago for this episode.
Right.
But, them's the breaks.
Yes.
So.
Well, there are definitely multiple things the GIF could have referred to in this episode as well.
Yes.
Hover.com/cat is today's promo code. Get 10% off your order at hover.com if you use hover.com/cat. Thanks to them for sponsoring us this season of Cast of Kings. Let's get into the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name's Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, here's what we do here on the podcast. We discuss and spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones. This week, we'll be discussing everything through Season 5, Episode 7, The Gift. We will not spoil anything from future week's episodes. That includes anything from book spoilers, anything from the next time on preview. None of that stuff will be spoiled on this episode. It will be primarily through a show watcher's eyes, although Joanna will be giving some context from a book reader's perspective as well. You can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. And also find us on Twitter and Facebook at A Cast of Kings. That's at A Cast of Kings. So before we get into this week's episode, a couple things we got to address about last week's episode, the response to it. The response was really intense all around the internet. I think that's fair to say. Like, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. Senators of the United States getting into the mix. Like, everyone seemed to have an opinion on the events depicted in last week's episode. Hundreds of you guys wrote in. Hundreds of people wrote in. And so we just wanted to say, like, there's no way we can get to all the emails. But we wanted to thank all the people that wrote in and offered their, like, perspective in a really civil fashion, in a way that was very kind of insightful and, like, came from a personal place. Really appreciated the overwhelmingly vast majority of those emails. I can say, I think, like, Joanna and I, like, we did a decent job of expressing our opinions last week, and I think, like, our opinions haven't particularly changed that much, even after reading over the mountains of emails. And I think, you know, that's true of a lot of people. Like, their opinions on last week's, you know, final scene probably is true, you know, the same this week as it was last week. So that being said, wanted to say thank you for all the emails. Wanted to also bring up comments at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. It's hosted at slashfilm.com. They are becoming too challenging for us to moderate at this point in time. And so as a result, for the rest of the season, there will be no comments at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can always let us know what your comments are at acastofkings@gmail.com. You can also comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/acastofkings. But there's not going to be any comments at slashfilm.com just because, like, there's just hundreds and hundreds of comments, and, like, some of them have spoilers, and it's just, like, becoming incredibly challenging to moderate them in such a way that is productive for everyone. So we would ask you divert your comments to those other sources, and that is where we will consume and integrate them into the show. So All that being said, why don't we get into this week's episode? This week's episode, season 5, episode 7, The Gift. Wow, action-packed episode of the show, Jonna. I mean, so much stuff happened in this episode.
Yeah, it was the running time was a little longer than usual.
Yeah, and they were like burning through plot points like left and right. It was incredible like how quickly it was happening.
Yeah.
So where do we start? I think we started this episode at the wall, which has my favorite character, Ollie, of course, who comes into play
Your boy, Ollie.
Comes into play again this episode, Jonna. I mean, in a big way. Am I right?
Blowing his brow.
So this episode begins with like John setting Tormund free, right? And John's going on this like crazy cockamamie mission to round up the wildlings and help them to defend the South, right, against the White Walkers. Is that
right? That he would bring them over to the southern side of the Wall. Give them that's another reference for the gift. Give them a piece of land that's called the gift. That they could farm and use. And then in theory, when the White Walkers came, they would be on the same side as the Night's Watch in terms of defending the South.
So Alistair Thorne is not super, or as I like to call him, poor man's Ridley Scott, is not super happy to, he looks like Ridley Scott's face got smaller a little bit on his skull.
Do you think he used to be a ginger like Ridley Scott?
I'm not sure. I am not sure. But it wouldn't surprise me. I just think, wow, that is a great stand-in for Ridley Scott every time I see him. Anyway, Alistair Thorne, he is not happy with John's plan. Right. He voices his objection. Ollie is super not happy, and of course his opinion we should value greatly.
Of course, yes.
And then John and Sam have this nice moment, right, where Sam gives John the dragon glass and is like, hey, I killed a White Walker with this. Hopefully it'll serve you well. Now, does he give him multiple pieces? I felt like he gave him multiple pieces.
Yeah, so back in season 2, Sam unearthed this bag of right. dragonglass weapons at the Fist of the First Men. And I think a lot – it was this and John's direwolf, which also came back in this episode. I think a lot of people were like, where's that bag of dragonglass that Sam dug up? Why has he never mentioned it? So I think it was good that came back into play this week.
So he gives it to John, and who knows if John will use it. And that's the last we see of John this episode. So then we cut to a scene with like Aemon and Gilly and Sam, and we essentially see Aemon die, right?
Yeah,
and it's a pretty heartbreaking scene because, like, you know, he's a great actor and he comes off as like incredibly respectable and admirable in the show. And to see him die, and like, what were his last words? Like, he had a dream that he was old, right, or something like that.
I'm not sure that those the character's final words, but that's straight from the book. The egg, I dreamed that I was old. Like, thinking he's talking to his little brother is very, very emotional and touching.
Right, which gave me chills because you think about it and like. You know, have you ever had a dream where you died before? You know what I mean?
Like, oh, I have.
And you die and you like wake up, right? And then you're like, oh, wow. Like, I thought I was dead, but I'm actually alive. And you're like grateful to be alive. And it occurs to me, like, when you get to the point where you're actually dying, like, you might consider that is only a dream. And like, but that you could be wrong in that and then actually be dying, I just found to be a terrifying thought.
Yeah.
Very sad. And, you know, he's like kind of like incoherent at the end. But he does urge Gilly Flower, which I didn't know was even a thing, to take, you know, to leave and head south.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say about this scene?
I don't know that it's that the gravity of it sort of hits home as much in the show. I mean, on a personal level for Sam. But in the books, they make it clear that Aemon Targaryen, or they call him the oldest living man in Westeros. He's 102. And like, you know, as I think we talked about a couple weeks ago with him, he gave up the Iron Throne and let his younger brother take it. And then like we've had, I don't know, so many kings since, not even counting the Baratheon, you know, rigmarole. There were like 3 Targaryen kings after him. So he's old. He's got so much history in him. So the loss of him is just like a huge loss to this world, all
like
the
Westeros
history that he had.
Yeah,
exactly. And Sam's eulogy, which I really loved, is also directly from the book. And I thought it was really touching. And then Alistair Thorne gets in there and drops a little menace on him, saying, you know,
all your friends are, sense, Yeah, all your friends are dying, right?
Or, yeah, or are gone, or gone, leaving you. Yeah. Or you're losing all your friends, Charlie. That's what he says.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have an image here of Tully here. What's going on with in the show notes here?
Oh, okay. So we said that the interview stuff that Dan and David do after the show is fair game, right?
Yes, we did.
So David Benioff says that Aemon Targaryen is the first character to die of natural causes on Game of Thrones.
Right.
And he's like the first character that we know to die of natural
that
causes.
That we see die of natural causes.
Yeah, but Catelyn's dad, Hoster Tully, which they like, you know, they tried and failed a couple times to light his boat on fire. He died of old age as well.
Wow,
so.
Joanna, nitpicking the post-game credits or the,
well,
post,
I think David,
the post-game
I think,
show.
I think David Benioff at least said like, I think he's the
yeah,
first.
Yeah, yeah. No, he was very unsure about it. I think he said it kind of jokingly. So
yeah.
But yeah, it is worth noting that the vast majority of people on the show don't die of natural causes.
So. Right. They usually die of something horrible. So, you know, Aemon died of being 102. So.
Yeah. Which is, a very tranquil death compared to what we see on the show.
Yeah.
So what else happened? Members of the Night's Watch attempt to rape Gilly. The next scene. Sam steps in, you know, and, you know, like gets completely clobbered, although
but,
raised
but
himself.
But keeps standing up.
This reminded me of the scene in The Simpsons where – you ever see that episode of The Simpsons where Homer becomes a boxer? And it's explained that he's only a good at boxing because his brain is so small that the fluid around his brain is able to insulate him from any impact. And so that's why he's able to take like – constant amount of abuse until his attackers basically get tired and go and like collapse. That's what it felt like because they wail on Sam and he's just like completely like shrugs it off and gets up again.
He gets back up.
And
well, we know Sam has a huge brain, so. But
yeah, that's true. So that's the only thing that doesn't. That's the only part of Game of Thrones that doesn't match with The Simpsons. But
yes, that's it. Otherwise, 100% dead match. I will say that. Okay, so you know we're going to talk a little bit more about Sansa when we get to Sansa's section. Brace yourselves. But here I will say that you know last year when there was a whole Cersei Jaime rape thing that happened, or however you want to characterize it, the following week was all the Craster's Keep stuff where there was just like rape going on like in the background everywhere. And like I will say this week what I said then, which is like I just really wish they had taken a week off from rape or attempted rape. I was not delighted that this Gilly thing happened this week. It doesn't happen in the book, so it's just a thing that they added, and I think we're all just like done with the conversation and not wanting to have it.
The only thing I would say is quote unquote worth pointing out is like she essentially says like, hey, if people ever try to rape me again, just like don't do anything. Like just let it happen. Which I think like I read online like people found that to be a little bit problematic.
Yeah, it's problematic. And also I wish this hadn't been the first time they had sex because it seems a little like it's an old trope of like, oh, I'm so grateful you saved me from rape, I'll have sex with you is actually a thing that happens sometimes in stories and I don't like it. So
because in reality that usually doesn't
like,
it
that's usually,
doesn't play
not
out that way.
What you're in the mood for. So I think the Sam and Gilly relationship has been like interesting. I like that it's sort of a slow blossoming thing between them. And I wish that this first encounter, which in the books is about their grief over Aemon's death, and not sort of, you know, an attempted rape. I wish that it had been tied to something else, I guess.
So I think like, my only thought is I'm kind of echoing some of my thoughts from last week, which is like, I'm just curious/ confused about like what Gilly is even doing at the wall. Like she's what is her day to day activities? Like where does she like sleep? You know, like how has this not happened sooner? Is I guess my reaction is like I feel like she is probably like under the threat of violence at all times. So I'm just curious, like what her role is at at the wall.
Yeah, and that's a decent point. In the books, there are a lot more wildlings there at the time, and some of them are – she's not like the only female right. in the entire castle, you know? So I think in the story – for the story's purpose, it's like Tormund's the only other wildling there, whereas after the battle, there were a lot of them.
Well, that's not true. Like we see like a bunch of wildlings like watching Mance get burned alive. So he is tormented with a bunch of his people.
You're right. Yeah. But a bunch is maybe generous, I would say.
Like
a small handful. Yeah.
Three a bunch? So, yeah, I mean, with Gilly, yeah, it's just like, I'm just like, what? Like,
yeah.
It just feels like not a good place for her to be in general. And every time she's on screen, I'm always like, why are you not fleeing this area as soon as you can? Like,
right.
Again, I'm not saying she asked for it or anything like that. Not saying anything like that. I'm just saying, like, this seems like a generally dangerous place.
Stannis is not going to leave his daughter there.
Right.
You know?
I'm worried about her, and I, you know, like, hope something happens to, like, alleviate this situation. So, yeah. Anyway, so speaking of Stannis, he, decides to decamp and head south to try and take Winterfell, despite Davos saying, like, this is a really bad idea, Stannis. And Stannis is like, look, I don't want to be the king who ran. I gotta do this. This is the only opportunity. In the show, it's hinted at how long winters last, like years, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I guess it probably is a spoiler to ask you, like, how long do they last, or do we ever experience a winter in the books? But yeah, I mean, beyond years, I don't know that we know how long winters last here. So we can.
Well, I'll tell you this.
Yeah.
This is not a spoiler. People like Bran or Sansa or Arya, they've been referred to as sweet summer child, meaning they were born in the summer and they've never experienced a true winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how long a season can last, that like you can live your life, like your youth, and not experience a winter. So the fact that it's snowing the way it is in Winterfell right now, snowing on Bran, snowing on Stannis, is, you know, unusual, and not everyone lives to see that snow come that far down.
Which, by the way, like, I'm maybe about to step into another, like, metric pile of dog poo here, but I feel like in general, like, in reality, snow doesn't behave in real life the same way it behaves in the show, because they're not using snow in the show, right? They're using fake snow, so they can replicate it over multiple takes. I feel like fake snow accumulates at a rate far faster than real snow does, because like real snow often like melts on contact and so on. That's not to say real snow can't accumulate on people. Obviously it does, but I always like get distracted by looking at the snow and how it behaves on people's bodies when I'm watching a show like Game of Thrones. And hopefully now you won't be able to stop thinking about it too.
I don't know. I'm from California. We don't think about snow.
I see. Well, that's good for
you. We're sweet summer children all year round. No.
So a few things worth pointing out with this Stannis exchange. Right? Obviously, like the whole idea of him not being able to go south and like wanting to and like this being his last chance, that all makes sense. Him talking with Melisandre. Like one question that's come up is, for me, is like, why can't they make another smoke baby and like kill Roose Bolton? That's never explained in the show. Is it explained? Like, don't tell me the reason if it is explained in the books, but is it explained in the books?
I think in the rules that they set up in the show, there should be no reason that they are not, you know, knocking the pieces off another map table and making another smoke baby. I don't think it's been satisfactorily explained.
In the books, is it though?
It's a little different.
Mm, okay.
But what I will say is that, you know, Melisandre is doing her favorite move, is that she wants to burn some royal blood. And in the books, John is worried about him. Like, Melisandre wants to burn a baby that doesn't exist in the show, but there's a baby at the wall that Melisandre wants to burn because it has royal blood. They're worried she wants to burn Aemon Targaryen because he has royal blood. Like, she is wants to burn royal blood, having people all the time. So the fact that she wants to burn Shireen is not all that shocking to book readers. But I mean, as a show watcher, of course, you're like, what? She wants to burn that cute child?
Right. And they just had that nice moment, you know, last episode. Like, I guess, like, that's totally a thing Game of Thrones would do.
Yeah.
Is, like, set up this lovely relationship and you get to feel something. And then now, of course, you're setting up a situation where it has to be taken from him, right? It actually, now that I think of it, it really does kind of mirror the this story of Abraham and Jacob in the Bible, if you're familiar with that story, right?
Where, yes.
Is it Abraham and Isaac? Which one is it? I forget. But basically, yeah, it's Isaac. Sorry. Abraham and Isaac.
It's Jacob and Esau.
That's right.
And Joseph and the amazing Technicolor dude.
Correct. Correct. Okay. In the Bible, Abraham, his wife is unable to conceive for the longest time. But God promises him that your descendants will be as numerous as the stars. And finally they have a child and his name is Isaac and oh my gosh, it's a miracle because his wife is quite old when they conceive. And, one day God tells him to bring that child out into, the middle of the woods or whatever, tie him up and then sacrifice him, plunge a dagger through him, because God asked for it, apparently, because that's what he's interested in. And then at the last second, God stays Abraham's hand and, saves him. Saves Isaac, I should say, from doing what...
And he says, your faith was enough.
Yeah, your faith was enough. Your faith was enough. And I get that it just reminds me of the scene because, he obviously has his daughter who he loves more than anything in the world and is being asked to sacrifice... the daughter by not God, but an emissary from the gods,
And and that's what was so interesting about that tender Shireen and Stannis scene, which was not in the books. But I think a lot of us, when we saw that, were like, oh my God, they're going to try to burn Shireen, aren't they? Because why else would they set up this tender moment? And she's going Melisandre and Melisandre loves burning royal blood anyway. I've been a little worried about Shireen. And I'm a little unsure about what Stannis is going to do.
Right.
I like to think that Stannis, who saved his daughter, from Grayscale and, said that sweet thing to her and finally gave her a hug, wouldn't burn his child. But yes, he loves her according to that scene. But he also loves his ambition or his conviction that he's the right person to rule. Is it going to be a needs of the many over the needs of the few sort of thing? We'll have to see. But it's an upsetting proposition to be sure.
Someone also pointed out, I don't remember which recap I read, but someone also said that she was talking about the vision they saw and Bolton banners lowered to the ground, right?
Uh-huh.
Which could be interpreted multiple ways. I wonder if it's one of those monkey paw situations where it's you get what you want, but at some horrifying price, or there's some weird, bizarre, ironic twist to it that the Boltons lower their banners to the ground, but
and then stab you with
they're faking you out, or there's something there that might not be quite on the level.
Right.
So maybe we will see Bolton banners lowered to the ground, but it won't. If I had to bet money, I would say we will see Bolton banners lowered to the ground, but it won't be because Stannis is victorious. That's where my money is going. I assume you know the answer to this question, right, Joanna?
I think I'm going to pivot and talk really quickly about this other cute little show book nod in the scene where he talks about the Stormcrows, who are these mercenaries who have deserted him.
Yes.
And I don't believe that they talked about them in the show before. So that's just a little book nod because, I don't know, there's 100 mercenary groups in Meereen at this point and the show has simplified them, but they name dropped one of them to be hey, we read the books. We did. We swear. So. I'm not gonna answer your other thing.
Yeah, no worries. I like how you're not even telling me if you even know what the answer is. That is a level of spoiler aversion that we're at on this show, and I love it. All right, let's jump to Dorne. Let's go to Dorne because, man, that last week's scene was rough. The sand snakes. That was the fight scene. It looked like Dorne had no people in it. It was just a rough.
Talk about the Alcazar, the filming constraints on Cast of Kings last week?
No.
So if you watched the sort of day in the life of Game of Thrones video before the season, which I did, a listener pointed this out to me that, they were talking about, they shut down the Alcazar in Seville for shooting. It's generally open to the public. They shut it down so they could shoot. And it would make sense then that their timing would be really constrained. And so if they're shooting in the courtyard of this, castle that they only have a certain number of hours of daylight in, maybe they don't have time to get things looking as good as they should. And so that maybe is why the courtyard scene looked so terrible last week.
Right. And that's, I directed a film in the last year. Very, if Game of Thrones is a 10 on the scale of complexity,
Yeah.
You know, then the film I directed is 0.00000000001. So I'm not at all comparing anything I did to what Game of Thrones does. I will say, if you want to check out my film, it's world premiering on May 29th at the Seattle International Film Festival. It's called The Primary Instinct. Buy tickets at SIFF.net. But yeah, filmmaking, you find filmmaking when you get into it is like an endless series of compromises. It's just like you only have enough money to do this, you only have enough time to do this, and you have to decide, like, do you want to do A or B? Like, do you want to give up, do you want to spend more time working on this scene and then give up time working on another scene? Like, which one will make more impact? And, like, you make all these trade-offs, and at the end you have a movie. In this case, at the end you have a TV show. And so it's kind of an interesting thought exercise. Like, would they have been better off, like, choosing a less beautiful location but being able to spend more time at it, right? Like does that make for a better fight scene? Right.
I think so. Like, I think that it would have been better if they had just shot it on a back lot, and, you know, they have enough money that they can make the back lot look amazing.
Right.
And some of those external shots where they're like walking in the beautiful gardens are nice. But I mean, is the payoff of this clumsily executed fight scene worth it?
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, Joanna, okay, you can say that, but we can also say that, like, you just can't know unless you're in it, right? Like,
sure. Yes.
We don't know what trade-offs. Maybe there was no backlot. Like, this was the only option, you know? Like, they couldn't find any backlots for 300 miles, you know? Like, who knows? But yeah, I mean, it is worth, like, asking the question, like, yeah, like, I want, you know, just, it's just interesting to think about, like, is that a good idea, you know, to trade, like, beautiful location for, like, more well-choreographed, well-shot scene. Who knows?
And honestly, like, I'm trying to give them, like, credit almost. Like, okay, maybe they didn't have time to fix this,
right,
and they did it the best they could in edit or whatever. And that was a result of a choice that they made. But, you know, they weren't like, well, this is, we got it. Let's call it a day. You know, like, maybe – I mean, I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, and it's often rare when you're like – from my very limited experience, I can say it's rare when you get to the end of the day and you're like, wow, we definitely got everything we needed, and I have zero doubts about that. You know what I mean?
Right.
So Dorne, we get a continuation of the scene where there's two scenes in Dorne. Jaime confronts Marcella, and Marcella's like, I'm not going back. You don't know me, Dad, right? Essentially. She doesn't know he's her dad, but you know. Like, she says, like, you know, you don't know who I am, and like, that's
Well, she was more working out her issues with her mom. She's like, my mom made me come here.
Right.
She shipped me off to Dorne. I did what she said. I landed into a good situation where I actually like the guy I have to marry, and now she wants me to come home.
Right.
I don't think so. No. So.
Right, which is completely which, by the way, she shows a lot more initiative than like Theon did when he was sent back home. Like, as a ward of the state. Anyway. So I think that when she's like, you don't even know me, like, that's supposed to be, like, biting. You know, Jaime is this person's father and was not able to be her father, right? And that is terrible, right? I mean, it's terrible that he's her father in the first place, but, you know, if you're going to be, you know, this person's incestuous father, you might as well be there for her, which he wasn't able to be because, you know, variety of reasons.
And I don't know that scene landed as well as I wish it had.
How so?
Yes. I don't know. I just didn't feel, you know, I think the world of Nicola Coster-Waldau, so I can't really fault a performance, but I just didn't feel like that as a gut punch to Jaime. I get conceptually why it's a gut punch, but like, I didn't feel that in that scene.
Hmm. Yeah,
it just sort of came and went.
Yeah, I mean, they went through so much, like, so many plot developments this episode. But yeah. I did feel that gut punch. I felt for him because it's like he's just, you know, in a horrible situation. You know, he's like his whole situation is bad. You know, like he's fathered these children and he can't even acknowledge that he's fathered them, because if he did, it would be a huge scandal and people already think that about him and it's already kind of a scandal. You know, it's just bad for him. So, you know, that being said, he obviously did push Bran out of a window and do all these horrible things. But it's, you know, we're at a state – he's obviously softened up a little bit since then, right? Can we say that? I don't know. I don't know if we can. Is it just me or has he gotten less blonde over the years too? Another random observation.
Yeah, I think – well, I don't know if he was wearing a wig in the first season, but ever since they cut his hair
– I don't – what is going on with that hair, man? Like, it used to be so kind of, like, rich and full, And now it feels kind of like scruffy, you know?
Yeah, it was probably a golden flaxen wig before, and then, you know, when he was a prisoner, they like cut off his head hair, and he had that. He had like the long greasy hair when he was a prisoner.
Right.
So I guess it was when he got back that he cut off his like prison hair and beard. I don't know.
Speaking of unfortunate things happening in prison.
Yes.
We get this completely bizarre scene in the jail with Bronn and the sand snakes.
Yeah. Right?
Like every element of this was just bizarre.
Yeah.
No,
I disagree. Bronn singing the rest of the Dornishman's Wife was great.
Correct. That was awesome. And he's obviously a very good singer, right?
Yeah. Someone has put together both halves because he sang half of it on horseback and half the rest in the jail cell. So you can find that online. Like someone put them two together so you can hear Jerome Flynn singing all of that. And we should probably mention really quickly that for Red Nose Day, this charity television event, Coldplay did this great Game of Thrones musical sketch, or I thought it was great anyway. I really liked it. Some pieces worked better than others, but it's kind of a sin that Jerome Flynn was not involved in that at all because he is such a good singer. So,
yeah.
Did you see it? Sorry.
No, I saw the first part of it. It was amusing. Yeah, but he's a great singer, and I agree that that part is excellent. But I went through a whole roller coaster of emotions watching this scene, Joanna. Firstly, it started with, oh, Bronn singing. Fantastic. Bronn insulting these women. Hilarious. Woman taking off her dress for some reason. Like, A, I'm aroused, but B, so, like, no good can come of this. You know, and then, oh, wow, like, they actually poisoned him? So, wait. I thought her, like, I don't know, her boobs had some kind of magical powers.
Oh.
I mean, like
poisonous breasts.
Yeah, that, like, the, you know, like a Medusa situation where, like, if you look upon them, then you will feel lightheaded and pass out.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't put that aside, for Game of Thrones to do something like that. And then it's like, oh, wait, he's been poisoned? He's going to die? Bronn's going to die? Like, I start panicking, like, Bronn's going to die? And like this? You know? Not like this. Bronn can't die like this. You know,
yeah.
And then, oh, thank God there's an antidote. But wait, that antidote's got to be fake. Why would she give that to him just for saying she's a beautiful woman? That makes absolutely no sense. She gives it to him. Oh, my gosh, is Bronn actually going to die? Maybe he was fine and the antidote is actually a poison. But nope, it's actually the antidote and the scene is over.
Yeah.
That is what went through my head that whole time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what was your reaction to that?
I wasn't very charmed by it. I mean, so I knew when she hit him with a knife last week, I knew that it was poisoned. Not because this happens in the book, but just because like the camera focused too long on it, and the Martells are known for poisoning, or Oberyn was known for poisoning the tip of his weapon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when this week started and they're like, previously on, Bronn got cut, I'm like, all right. That's definitely poison. And I don't know, it kind of bums me out because she already got the best of him. Like, I think a lot of people think this nudity scene was about a woman using her sexuality to get the best of a man and having power. But like, he was already poisoned. All she did was make his blood flow faster so that the poison worked faster.
I see.
You know, like, wasn't that her breasts and magical powers? I think she just, like, made the blood flow in his body faster. So
have to explain, it wasn't that her breasts had magical powers to me.
You know, and people like Ava DuVernay, a director I really respect, she thought this scene was awesome. She tweeted about it. She's like, you know, sand snakes doing it for themselves or whatever. So there are definitely, like, some women out there who think that this was an awesome, empowering scene. You know, I think they just wanted to show the breasts of a 19-year-old actress, which they did at length. And
find empowerment in whatever you want. I don't begrudge it. But it is bizarre to me that threatening someone with death to get them to admit you're beautiful would be an empowering thing. Like, I will confess that is confusing to me. You know what I mean? Like, I do not understand that.
I will say that my favorite part of that scene, though, was Obara and Nymeria, her sisters, like, in the background were, like, rolling their eyes pretty hard. Like, maybe that this is a thing she does all the time. They're like, oh, here she goes.
Here she goes with the whole
– with the old boob trick.
With the whole poison the dude with her blade well before she has to force him to look at her boobs.
Yeah. So,
and then take the antidote out of her necklace.
I think, you know, and there is a character in the books who uses her sexuality for power in Dorne, but yeah, I just don't think we've had enough character development in these Sand Snakes at all. Like, what do we know about them now? They're angry. They have these weapons. One of them has
a
really solid rack, really great breasts. You know, and it's just not great.
So basically what you're saying is Ollie is way better developed than the Sand Snakes.
I mean, it depends on your definition of developed.
Oh, yeah. As a character, I mean.
Probably.
We are letting these puns run too fast for us right now.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so this scene was pretty confusing, and
but I'm glad Bronn's not dead. Delicious.
Yes, I was actually like very worried about that, and like if he was gonna die, like he should not die like that. You know what I mean? Like that's not a good way to die.
This particular scene was leaked as part of that actress's audition. Leaked like months ago, but I think it was never entirely clear whether or not it was real. I don't believe there was any mention of her disrobing in the audition scene. I think they saved that for later, but the dialogue is the same. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't feel like this scene like communicated these ideas of these characters very well. But you know, let's say you want to communicate an idea.
How would I do
really
that?
Clearly, you know, you'd probably need a domain name for it.
What?
Dude, these segues, they get more inventive every week. Hover.com/cat. Cat is there for absolutely no reason. This whole sponsorship is a disaster this week. But hover.com/cat is the domain name you got to – is the URL you got to go to if you want to get a domain for 10% off your first purchase.
Nice.
Hover.com, when you have a great idea, you got to get a great domain name for it. You want to represent your idea in a clever, interesting, compelling way. And hover.com/cat is a way to do that. Hover doesn't believe in heavy-handed upselling. You know, often you'll go to a domain registrar, you'll try to buy a domain name, and you'll need to click like 15 times before you get to where you need to go. And hover.com doesn't believe in that. They believe in like really frictionless process. Just go to hover.com/cat. And instead of charging you for something that should be there, Hover just includes everything you need, like Whois privacy that's always free on every domain that supports it. And they don't do heavy-handed upselling. They just get you straight to where you need to go. They also have some really cool like domain names as well, like .audio and .photography. And so, like, if you want to be on the cutting edge of domaining, you know, like .xyz, got to use hover.com/cat. And you can get whatever you need. So yeah, like I'm very curious, like how much these like other domains are gonna like take off. You know what I mean? Like, will we ever think of like .photography as, you know, a like valid domain? Like when will those be listed in, you know, online search, or .design or .click? You know what I mean?
And then there was this whole controversy, right, about. Basically celebrities being blackmailed into buying offensive domain names.
Right, like there is a dot sucks.
Right. So if I were to buy like Ollie.sucks,
then you might
want to get there first.
Well, people would like think you're incredibly ill informed about how well Game of Thrones is using the Ollie character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But yes. So anyway, so many cool like names that like you could firstly, like, regardless of how well they are like picked up on, you know what I mean? Like, it's just cool to be able to have like dot fishing or dot poker or dot rodeo or dot wedding. Like, if I was gonna get married, I'd use a dot wedding.
Oh, dot domain. Wedding for sure. Yeah,
that's key. Actually, you should probably buy that one right now for whoever you're with, because who knows, you might end up using it. Right?
That might be a relationship deal breaker, though. What if you find out that the person has like bought your wedding domain before you were ready to have the conversation?
Like, if you're not making a generalization here, but if your girlfriend had bought like a, you know, so and so and you dot wedding domain name, like, would that be like a, you know, like, would that be like discovering that they had drawn a doodle with you and like three kids? You know what I mean? In their diary? Yeah,
scary stuff, man.
Agreed. Well, you can live out these fantasies at hover.com/cat. Get 10% off your first domain order. In addition to the fine people at Hover, got to thank all the people that donated the Kickstarter.
Yes.
To this podcast. Joanna, why don't you start thanking some people?
I would like to thank Joshua Edge from Fremantle, Australia. Matt and Jessica Post from Compton, California. Roger Deng. Hisa Kiku Abe. Jonathan Durkoop. Jeffrey Woodward. Glenn from Sydney, Australia. Devin Fuller. Jack Scott Coombs. Aaron Southerned. No, that was awful. Grace Oregon. Tom Pattison. Stephen Pattison. Tony Kirkland Jr. and Barbara from Petaluma.
First of all, let me just say that like all these people are awesome, but Oregon has got to be a difficult name to deal with. And I say, but I say that like, you know, David Chen is also like a difficult name to deal with, but like in a different way, because there's so, I know like three David Chens. It's like a completely unremarkable name. But yeah, anyway,
here's what I'm going to say. If you're reading a list of names and you mess up one, then the rest are just, it's like agony. You're like on a roll and then you mess up one and then you're like, oh no.
It's like falling down like at the Olympics. It's like once you've fallen down, it's like why even bother, you know, trying the rest, you know?
Yes.
Mia Moore, Frederick Gutteson, Paul Appleby, Lisa Hawthorne, Neil Thompson, JP Gagan, Muriel Gonzalez, Paul Pantia, Doug Cornelius, Johari Ismail, a fan, Daniel Bertrand, Chris Visser, Elise Hannaford, and Andrew Monk. Thanks so much for your contributions to
Thank
the Game Thrones Kickstarter. Really appreciate it. And you guys helping to support us, it's a huge deal for us. Also grateful to Hover.com/cat for sponsoring us this whole – they just bought out half the season for us, and we think they're awesome as well. So if you're thinking of buying a domain, get that .wedding domain name, guys. Hover.com/cat. All right, let's finish the rest of this episode, Joanna. So a few more plot lines to discuss. Why don't we get to Winterfell now? I wanted to save it for after our life.
We don't want to just like skip Winterfell entirely.
I wanted to save it. I didn't want it to affect our lighthearted banter about Hover.com. okay. So Winterfell. Yeah. Few things happen. Few things happen. Firstly, we see like the physical toll that being married to Ramsay takes on Sansa. Like there's just bruises all over her body.
Yeah, many multicolor bruises. Yeah. Amazing technicolor bruises. Yeah,
looks pretty rough. That is inappropriate, Joanna. But yes, it is pretty. It looks beyond the psychological damage.
Yeah,
the physical damage is very apparent, and I just feel like from a tactical standpoint, I feel like between. Like, obviously, the getting married to Ramsay and the whole thing, like, whatever. Like, I think that, in my opinion, that played out in a reasonable fashion. Like, you know, not reasonable in the sense of, like, decent human being, but reasonable in the sense of, like, there is nothing that she did that I didn't understand why she did it. But there is stuff that, like, walking down a freaking dark, unknown hallway full of, like, deadly dogs. I'm just like, what are you doing? And then, you know, add to that list telling Theon about this whole plan. Yeah. I just felt like... why would you do that? You know this person has – like you're telling the one person who like – like A, I guess he's the only person that could help you. But like also you know he's been brainwashed. You know he serves Ramsay. You know like he fears Ramsay with like nothing else. Why are you telling him like the one thing that could get you out of the situation? That was my reaction. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean –
were you like, that is completely reasonable, Sansa, for you to reach out to Theon?
I don't know. We don't know everything she told him, right?
Well, she
like,
said...
do you think
like,
she said... and she said she has friends. She said, put this candle in the Broken Tower. Do you think she said, there's an old lady with gray braids that told me? Because if so, that's a bummer. Maybe she could have held that one back.
Maybe, you know... been a little bit more taciturn with that.
I think a lot of people watching expected this to work. I mean, even as Theon like goes up the tower steps and into Ramsay's study or whatever, I think people still expected that she and Theon were bonded after last week. I think that was what a lot of people thought that the results.
I did not think for a second that it would happen that way.
Oh, okay, okay.
Like,
you were like
just because like that is not how Game of Thrones. Like you know, this is I think like where I really. Like Ned's death in season one, like that certainly subverted my expectations. But then there's a scene in season three, I think, with the Red Wedding, right? Where Kat says to Rob, or season two is the Red Wedding? Which one is it? I don't remember. But Kat says to Rob, like, show them what it feels like to lose something you love. And then you're like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so freaking badass. And the show's like getting you riled up and then completely undercuts it by having everyone die.
So you never – so it was season three, by the way. So like you never gave Game of Thrones your heart again.
Yeah, so after that, I'm just like, I am never trusting you to do anything.
Even
like,
even when Oberyn got into the ring last season?
You may have got me there. But, you know, still, like, okay, that too, right?
Right.
So that on, it's like, look, this show is not going to give you what you want from a narrative perspective.
Gotcha.
So I was just like, there's no way this is going to – in fact, like, the whole – you know, I'm, like, watching freaking the opening scene of Scream. You know, I'm like, dude, get out of the house. Like, and in this case, I'm like, why are you doing this? Do not trust Theon. It's almost like dramatic irony because we know how untrustworthy Theon is. Like, he should not be someone you give any trust to in this situation. So anyway, that's my reaction. Some people also reported that it's, like, edited confusingly, right? That, like...
Like, yeah, where Theon was going?
Yeah, like, because it shows, like, a POV shot from the tower. Then yeah. It shows Theon climbing something.
Yeah.
And then it shows him emerging to Ramsay. So, like, my takeaway from that was it was meant to make you think that he was climbing the tower when, in fact, he was climbing a completely different building.
I agree.
Okay. Yeah.
All the while, we see what Brienne watching in the snow. Great use of Gwendolyn Christie this week.
Yes. That is some, yeah. She clearly, they got their value out of her.
Yeah.
So yeah, any thoughts on this whole sequence? Like, does it feel like, I guess your reaction, which you hinted at earlier, is like, well, one of the arguments that like the rape scene was like a justified thing to show is like, well, it shows, it's to like show Theon's state of mind. And you know, therefore like when Theon like brings it back and like saves her or whatever, it will make the rape scene like completely quote unquote worth it, right? And then like this scene like undercuts that argument,
right?
Is that your belief? Because I guess like my response to that is that like it only undercuts it insofar as, you know, showing endless torture scenes of Theon in season three was like They show this person like endlessly being tortured, and then I guess in the end it kind of made sense that they had to show that all. And ditto here, like you see Sansa. It's always with Ramsay. Like you see Sansa's like machinations, like continuously frustrated by Ramsay. And I guess theoretically, if she ever overcomes Ramsay, like it will make that like more sweet. You know, that like that revenge was gotten. That she's been through all these horrible things. I guess that's the operating theory I have.
Let me ask you a question. Yes. If what we watched last week was not Theon having a come to Jesus moment about, you know, I need to band together with Sansa and against Ramsay, do you think the same could have been accomplished with like last week ending with like the door closing or something, and then this week we see the aftermath and the psychological torture. We see her like say, you know, he torments me every night. We see the bruises on her body. We see the courtyard thing. We see her accomplice like has been flayed. Do you feel like that is demonstrable? Ramsay is tormenting Sansa proof. Do we need that scene last week to get us there?
So I guess, again, like I'm very ambivalent about last week's final scene because on the one hand, I feel like it was incredibly upsetting and like, uh-huh. You know, and the arguments for it being gratuitous, I find to be like understandable at least. But on the other hand, I don't feel like it was that graphic. Like they didn't show you that much. And they showed it on Theon's face and like you heard it, right? But in terms of like what you actually saw, it was not that much. So I guess I'm a little bit torn about it because on the one hand, yeah, like it's upsetting, but on the other hand, like it's not as though like it was like super gratuitous from a visual perspective. So that's my position on it. Does that make sense? I know you don't agree with that, but does that make sense internally, like on some level?
We should,
do you feel like it internally coheres as a point of view?
Yeah, let's move on.
Okay, fair enough. Again, I'm not saying it was upsetting. I'm just saying
I didn't feel like
it was graphic in the way that, like, you know, other rape scenes and other depictions.
That rape could have been worse. That's true.
That was something that was an argument that people used, right? Like, I think you responded to, like, Peter Sagal, who was Wait, Don't Tell Me, who was like, guys, let me tell you, like, there are definitely, like, worse rapes out there.
Weird.
Which, is, like, a really weird argument.
Peter Sagal fandom.
Really, so really weird moment in Peter. But yeah, I'm not saying that's – let me be clear. Like, that's not necessarily my argument. I'm not saying, like, that rape could have been worse. Well, actually, no, I am saying, like, they could have showed it in a more visual and graphic and even more upsetting way, and they chose not to. But anyway, let's move on from that. So I think you make a valid point about, like, would you still be able to get the emotional impact of what's going on with Sansa without how they depicted it last week? And I think you're probably right. Like, yes, that is the case. So I will concede that as well. But Sansa also has other stuff this episode, right? She kind of, like, gets some digs in at Ramsay, right? And is like, hey, you're a bastard as well. Like, you're never going to inherit the kingdom.
I wanted to share this with you. I mean, you know, Sansa is doing – I support Sansa. I support Sansa, like, squirreling that corkscrew away up her sleeve, whatever she's going to do with it later. I'm excited to find out. But this did not seem, like, subtle. And maybe she's not going for subtle. Maybe she's not going for the Littlefinger or, like, Olenna approach or whatever. She's just, like, hammering Ramsay here. But it reminded me of, like, my favorite version of this, which is Back to the Future. Right, where you don't call Marty McFly chicken, like, don't call Ramsay a bastard. That's his word. Don't use it. So, you know, if Sansa was going for you know, some careful manipulation, this is not it. If she was looking to get in whatever dig she could in her shitty situation, then, you know, well done. But the information she got there was about her brother, right? Her pseudo brother John, to find out that he was, you know, on the subject of bastards, your brother Jon Snow is Lord Commander now. Isn't that interesting? So
right, which is kind of mirrors the scene last week when Jorah discovered, like, apparently, like, wall news just does not get out there. I think is what we're, like, the take home message from the last two episodes is, right?
One day I'll be Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North. You will be my lady and wardeness.
But isn't your stepmother pregnant?
What of it?
What happens if she has a boy?
Then I'll have a baby brother.
But he'll be the heir.
I'm Lord Bolton's eldest son.
But you're a bastard. A trueborn will always have the stronger claim.
I've been naturalized by a royal decree from...
Tommen Baratheon? Another bastard.
Bastards can rise high in the world. Like your half-brother, Jon Snow. Born the Bastard of Winterfell, now the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch.
It is weird that Littlefinger didn't tell her. Because Wall News does, like, some Wall News does. I don't know.
I guess I take credit for coining Wall News, by the way. So let's put that out there.
I guess it's, like, it's erratic who reads, like, the Daily Raven that comes from the Wall about, like, the goings on. Maybe Sansa's just not a, you know, a Raven reading kind of girl. So
yeah, she's like the Sarah Palin of.
Name one Raven, just one Raven.
So this is, by the way, like, Sarah Palin's never come up in this entire podcast history, and, like this season's just come up twice.
Oh, so, I was about to say, I thought you were going to say ever. I was like, no, I remember the last time.
Yeah, Sarah Palin. So a couple other things about this scene that I thought were worth pointing out. Firstly, like, we've talked about how Sansa's been incredibly subtle and genius manipulator in the past, right?
Yeah.
Like, when she's talking with Joffrey, and all her dealings with Joffrey, like, it's way more subtle than what she's doing here. And the thing is, it's interesting because she knows that Ramsay can cause her more emotional and physical pain.
Right.
But she decides to not be subtle anyway. She's just, like, really brazen with it. And so I interpreted that she just does not give a fuck at this point. Like,
that is a reasonable interpretation.
Yeah,
based
she's just
on
like, bring it here. On. Like, yeah. Whatever you have, like, just bring it on because, like, I can take. And of course, you know, she should not have underestimated the or overestimated the depths of Ramsay's depravity because, of course, in the next scene, like, we see that he's flayed this old woman, which, like. You know, like, in my opinion, like, this is, like, more upsetting than anything in the last 2 weeks. Like, that is just, like, a horrifying visual and, like, you know, his description of it, so deeply upsetting, right?
I guess here's the, like, last thing
yep.
I'll say this
week. Let's do it. Let's get it out here.
On rape culture. And that's this.
Yep.
For me, one of the more frustrating comparisons I saw people draw was between Theon's castration and Sansa's rape. And what I'll say is that young men like Theon don't get abducted and castrated, or old women don't get flayed and put on pikes in courtyards all the time. Women do get sexually assaulted all the time. So the context is different. So mm-hmm. when you talk about something being upsetting on screen, like I don't like to use the term triggering because I think it's loaded, but I will just say that just think about the context here.
Right.
Think about the real world parallels that are very true for sexual assault and far more rare and, you know, for castration via torture or being flayed. Those are horrific things to have happen, but there is an extra added layer of removal of this is a heightened fantasy world, whereas for sexual assault, that's not the case.
Right.
So,
like that, you must take into account, like it is part of culture, it is pop culture, and culture. There is a context, there is a cultural context that exists that it is entering into, and that must be taken into account when you evaluate any work of art. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. No, that's a fair point. That being said, I do
the fling was very upsetting.
I still do think it was very graphic.
I will
and upsetting.
Agree with you that it was very upsetting. Yes.
Well, good. Good. I'm glad we can.
I'm glad we can agree
that skinning an old woman alive is an upsetting thing.
Oh, poor lady.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess she did like give up the information. Like, I think that's the conclusion we have to draw. Is like she's like, okay, Theon, here's how it's supposed to go down. This old woman told me, blah blah blah. Right.
Yeah. And he said, right, in his description of how she died, that she did not give up any more information, right? Like, because yes. presumably he flayed her to find out who the light was for.
Right.
And she didn't give it up. So.
Yeah. But, you know, so she didn't. So presumably Ramsay doesn't know about Brienne, but he's clearly on alert now. He's definitely not going to let Sansa leave her room now. And, yeah, it's. What I actually really quote-unquote liked about the scene was Alfie Allen's performance.
Yeah, Alfie Allen's fantastic through all of it.
He's so good. And like when Sansa – and this is like the first time – like one of not that many times we've seen Sansa like completely break down. I mean we saw it last week too, but like this is like – you know like that was like physical distress. This is like something had – like she had seen her dad's head on a pike before. Do you know what I mean? And, like, I felt like her reaction to this was, like, far more distressing than, like, when she saw her dad's head on a pike in season one. Am I wrong on that, or?
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess I really felt it in a way that, like, you know, in the scene where, like, Joffrey forces her to
look yeah, no, I remember, head. And I, like, remember the look on her face.
Yeah, I remember the look on her face. Like, yeah. it's seared into your brain. But, like, all I'm focusing on in that scene is how horrible Joffrey is and how much I want him to die,
yeah.
right? And in this scene, like, all I'm focusing on is, like, wow, that is making a dramatic impact on Sansa.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so, deeply upsetting. But Theon, like, there is no – there's only like traces of regret. Do you know what I mean? Like he's not like, oh, I feel really bad about this. It's just like – that's just like his normal way of being now. You know? He's kind of like doing what he's supposed to do and he's like completely like – there is like – you know, in the back of his mind there's like little regret. But like overall this is like the new him. And
yeah, and something
it's more resigned and defeated rather than regret. You know what I mean? That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and he says the same to Sansa where he's like, you know, it's just better if you go along.
Yeah.
It'll be better for you if you do. Something I will say, to the positive to this episode and the storyline is it really feels like with Littlefinger gone, with, the hope of a life of an ally in Theon gone, with the lifeline that she had, out to Brienne gone, whatever Sansa does, in theory, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but in theory, whatever Sansa does, she's going to have to do for herself, right? Like, she asked Theon for help. It didn't work out. Littlefinger isn't there to protect her. Brienne's not going to come running in and rescuing her. So in theory, if like something good has happened for Sansa, she's going to have to figure out how to do that herself, which is an interesting, new place for this character to be. Right?
Or just figure out another way to light that candle, potentially.
Maybe, but do it herself.
Right. She can't trust Theon for that. I mean, I don't think you should have trusted him at all in the first place.
Right.
But she certainly can't now. And definitely Ramsay's going to be on the lookout for that. That was just such a bad strategic move,
Yeah.
Anyway.
I still don't think we needed last week to get us there, but
yeah.
It is interesting to see what Sansa does from here.
Here's what we can say. I think this is indisputable, right? That the show has a kind of fixation and fascination with Ramsay's cruelty. And wanting the viewers to experience it somehow, right? That they find – the showrunners find some kind of value in that. And I think it's safe to say your mileage will vary, right, with regards to your reaction to that.
I think they definitely – they really want another Joffrey,
Right.
And it's just not going to work quite as well because there was the whole, Jack Gleason – not only was Jack Gleason, a little bit better – I really like the actor who plays Ramsay, whose name I try not to pronounce because it's Welsh, but the actor who played Joffrey, he's this almost pretty blonde prince, and not this actor isn't handsome, but there's just an incongruity in Joffrey, given how young he is, given how golden blonde he is, given how beautiful his robes are, right. And then his base cruelty.
Right. Whereas the guy who plays Ramsay, if you're that's a serial killer, you'd be like, yeah, I understand.
Yep. Exactly.
I buy that. Yep.
Yeah.
Whereas if you show Jack Gleason, you'd be like, really? Wow, you'd never suspect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But with Ramsay, it's okay, yeah, I get it. I understand.
So they have to work harder to get us to that really, really, really repulsed place. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure we were already there after what he did to Theon. We were already there. We were Ramsay's a monster. What else was I going to say about this?
I was just saying the show had a fascination with his cruelty.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what's going to happen to Sansa. I have no idea. Honestly, I really don't. I don't. But my favorite theory, which was espoused by one of my co-hosts on Storm of Spoilers, is that when, someone comes to Winterfell, whoever it is, the gates open up and Sansa just starts rolling Bolton heads out the gates of Winterfell. That would be a satisfying ending that we're never going to see in Game of Thrones. But Sansa killing everyone.
It's it's in, the Professional or that movie, The Professional, where the elevator door is closed and everyone dies and then the elevator door is open and then bodies fall out basically.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. All right.
Final. We got a couple of other scenes.
I know. We made it through.
King's Landing. Oh, actually, no. Let's go to Marine first. So, Marine. So, there's a slave auction. Tyrion and Jorah are sold. It's funny that Tyrion completely wails on this guy, but did that come off as believable to you that beating up a slave handler would get you sold? I guess.
No. But Peter Dinklage was so – I really, really like this version of Tyrion. Tyrion scrapping and fighting to survive. I really, really like.
Right.
It makes more sense last week when he's talking his way out of it because that's what Tyrion does, right? Than this whole beating someone with chains. But I still liked this scene. And I even like what Ian Glenn is doing. He's largely silent, but he looks so resigned and also sort of oh no, I'm losing my buddy. Oh no, he's coming. Okay, here we go. I don't know.
So I don't know. I felt weird about the scene, Jonah, because, you know, did you see 12 Years a Slave, that movie?
Yes.
So there's, like, scenes where, like, they're selling slaves, and it is, like, so upsetting because it's based on reality, you know? And it's based on our history and a part of our history that we would rather not look upon.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, here there's a scene like that where there's some – firstly, it's interesting that, the races are kind of reversed, that it's, like, black people selling white men.
I think that was very intentional.
Right. So that was kind of – that was interesting that the show did that. But then it's just, like – you know, still upsetting no matter what the context, and it's kind of played for laughs in this episode.
I think we've had a lot of slavery in this series not played for laughs.
Right.
So I'm not excusing that. I think you make a valid point.
Yeah, it just made me feel weird. I felt weird laughing at it because I'm like, this is an inherently like upsetting situation, you know? So anyway, I thought that was – it just made me feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so then so then there's a scene where like the dude is telling them, you know, you're going to die today. This is going to be the most meaningful your life has ever been. And then Jorah, like upon hearing that the queen is there, he storms out and starts wailing on everyone. And then Tyrion tries to break free. And then this other dude comes up and then inexplicably sets him free with no explanation. And then he runs out and he like presents himself and he's the gift. Right.
Right.
From Tyrion, from Jorah, I should say.
Right.
So, yeah, how'd you feel about this sequence as depicted on screen, Jonah?
Okay, so this hasn't happened in the books yet. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Tyrion meeting Khaleesi has not happened in the books.
Right.
Wow. So that you must
welcome
have, like.
Welcome to a brave new world.
You must have, like, shat yourself when you saw this.
No, I knew it was happening, but welcome to a brave new world beyond the books.
Wait, how did you know it was happening if it hasn't happened in the books yet?
There were set photos.
I see.
Yeah. So
you spoiled yourself, basically.
Sure. I spoiled myself. Yeah. Yeah, there were set photos of them, so I was like, oh, okay, so we're going there. So, you know, we've accelerated all the way past all of Tyrion's book material, right? And, you know, Weiss and Benioff gave an interview to Entertainment Weekly where they basically said, listen, we're not doing a 10-year adaptation. We're not going to wait through all of the plot that happens in order to get these two characters together. We want them to be together. So we pressed fast forward on some things, which I approve of. Like, I know you were waiting for my approval.
I was on the edge of my seat. Does Joanna approve of this?
I approve. Yeah, I think it's great. Aren't you so much more excited about Dany scenes now that you know that Tyrion's going to be
in
them?
Heck yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. The one thing I will say, what occurred to me, you know, so like Dany is like repulsed to be there and she wants to leave because there's all this blood. And then I think the reason she reacts positively to Jorah is because he's like fighting, he's knocking people out but not killing them.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, ah, feats of strength without all the blood. That's really nice. But my question is, why didn't she recognize Jorah? He has the one outfit. He only has outfit. He was wearing a helmet.
That's your – I don't know that I interpret – I didn't have that interpretation. Like,
you think she recognized him? But as soon as he took off the helmet, her face dropped. And she's like, get him out of my sight.
I think she was like – I don't think it was like, oh, who is this strapping young man? I think it was like – I suspect something is wrong here and I'm not liking it, but I'm going to keep watching because obviously this is really compelling. That's kind
She's
of my interpretation.
Kind of smiling, though. For me, it's like when my knight is winning at Medieval Times, and I'm like, yeah, go, Green Knight. No? Okay. Anyway.
Medieval Times. Is that a
– You don't know what Medieval Times is?
Is that like a Renaissance-themed restaurant or something?
Have you seen the movie Cable Guy?
I have. That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah. That's what it is. okay. So anyway, and for the book readers, the guy who cut – Tyrion loose. A lot of people think he's referenced to a book character that never has not shown up in the show because he uses the same weapon, that strong Belwas. But right. I think that was just like an Easter egg for viewers. I liked it. I don't know. I really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of nonsense. Like, I'm like, does this guy work for the slaver? Like, what does he expect Tyrion going to run in there? Like, what's, you know, it just
it made no sense.
There's just all these questions. It wasn't that it was nonsensical. It's just like, I have no context for what's going on here, basically.
I also don't know where Tyrion got that file that he like pulled out of somewhere and started filing, but like, whatever. It doesn't matter because it was worth it to me to see like Peter Dinklage interacting with Emilia Clarke and all of a sudden, like, I'm way more excited about the Marine stuff. Not like, you know, not as if there aren't joys to be had from another Dario Danny bedtime strategy, let's roast all the masters scene, but like, I'm really glad that Tyrion's there.
In terms of the fight scene, I think it was okay. I don't think it was bad, but like, I guess I was hoping for, like, honestly, the thing I was hoping for was Gladiator. You know, like, you ever seen Gladiator? I mean, he's such a freaking badass in that movie. And obviously they had like a $150 million budget for one movie as opposed to a like $80 million budget for 10 hours. And so like, I understand you can't do what they, you know, Gladiator did, but it would have been nice if it was a little more Gladiator. Like, I didn't come away from that scene thinking, oh, Jorah's such a badass. I was just like, eh. Yeah,
he took down like seven people. Okay, but this is...
Yeah, but they're all like distracted. You know what I mean? I didn't feel like it was like... Yeah.
This is what I will say. A couple of things.
Yep.
First of all, the correlation I thought of was... I don't know if you've seen Spartacus, Blood and Sand, the Starz show. I've only seen the first episode just because so many people told me it was so good. Done by Stephen DeKnight, who did Daredevil. And... it opens with them, and I know that there are similar scenes in Gladiator and also probably the original Spartacus. It opens with them like below the pits, hearing the crowd, hearing the chanting, stuff like that. So to like see Jorah and Tyrion sitting there getting ready to fight, like I think those setups are really interesting.
That stuff was great. That was awesome.
The other thing I want to say is this is like a qualifying round, right? This isn't like the main fighting pit situation. This isn't opening the fighting pit. These guys are fighting so that they can get to the fighting pit.
Right. Which I think, okay. I get what you're saying.
So what I'm saying is if it looks like, you know, a little hard scrabble, maybe that's why.
Gotcha. No, fair. That's a fair point. I shall lower my standards for the, I thought was hilarious was how the dude, what's his name? The one that she's betrothed to?
His daughter.
His daughter. I just thought it was hilarious how he kept like making up rules. Like, I mean, like introducing these rules that we're unfamiliar with. Like, it's customary for like the queen to make the rounds. And it's like, okay, well, that's new. And then she's like, but the queen must stay until the last one has been killed. And I'm like, you're just making shit up. You know what I mean? Like,
I wouldn't put it past his dar.
It would be hilarious.
It's our ancient custom.
It would be hilarious if like none of those were actually rules and he was just saying that stuff. So anyway.
We don't have to spend too long on the Danny Dario scene, but I do want to say that it was my understanding, my interpretation, that he implied that his dar is in control of the Sons of the Harpy. The Sons of the Harpy aren't acting out anymore, and Dario thinks it's because his star is controlling them.
Right. No, that's a good call out, and I guess it's ambiguous as to whether he's correct in that.
Right.
We don't know for a fact. But it certainly seems that way based on the evidence that we have. So.
And he and then Dario has this whole plan where he thinks Daenerys should torch all of the masters.
Right. Which she may or may not act on. You're either a butcher or the meat, which is a great, you know, that's like, I was thinking when he said it, I was like, man, we got to make a compilation of, you know, all the great Game of Thrones quotes. Cause there's so many quotes between.
And we haven't even gotten to the best people in this episode yet. Right.
Right. You know, between the butcher and the meat and, you know, fewer, not less. Like, there's just so many amazing quotes. We got to capture. All right.
Yes.
King's Landing. Man, dude, we are running way over time here.
I know, and it's a bummer because this is the best stuff. Right?
Yes. So a lot of conversations happen here. Olenna and the High Sparrow have a conversation. And Olenna comes at it, I guess, like, you know, it's her place in life to suspect everyone of ulterior motives because she's surrounded by people who have ulterior motives. And I guess, like, our presentation of the High Sparrow, you know, it's very possible that his, you know, having power will corrupt him. But so far, he's like the closest thing to a person with pure motivations we have in the show. Right.
Right. But she's like someone who's watched five seasons of Game of Thrones and she's like, I don't trust you.
Whereas like we've seen like the absolute like poverty that the High Sparrow, like, why would you subject yourself to that? You know, and like consign yourself to not having that much power unless you really believed it. You know?
Right.
Anyway, they have this like tense talk, and I think the point that she tries to make is that like, hey, like we're gonna halt the supplies and stuff like that. And I think he was saying like, well, like who are the people that like actually like do the farming? You know,
right.
It's like people that I control, right?
I guess I feel like his response was a little bit like rhetorical, and right. hers was an actual threat, but it sort of seemed to work on her. What I want to say about this whole, you know, we'll get to each scene, but I think all this great stuff that they gave for Jonathan Pryce to do in this episode made up for a lot of corners that they cut in establishing the Sparrows in the first place, mm-hmm. I think. That interaction with Elena and then later with Cersei, I love all this High Sparrow stuff.
He's so good. He's like the Nina Gold, who does the casting for the show, and like he's just so perfectly cast.
Yeah.
You know, like ridiculously good, because he has that exact like level of like emotional detachment and like kind of like Morgan Freeman-esque like handing down, you know, statements from above kind of thing. I think he does a fantastic job. So Elena and the High Sparrow, she can't bribe him, basically. That's the thrust of that scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then Cersei and Tommen have a scene where like Tommen finally like starts to show that maybe his testicles have dropped a little bit. And he's like, I love this woman. I'm going to, you know, like, and then like Cersei's like, well, I will talk to the High Sparrow. And then in my head, when she said that, I said to myself, Tommen's going to say, you would do that for me, you know? And, that's pretty much exactly what he said. He's so hopelessly naive and powerless. But maybe, you know, not quite as naive as like Cersei is with regards to who she's trusting.
The thing that I liked about this scene, which was actually quite long, and I was impressed that they kept the whole – like I don't think they needed to have that scene in there at all necessarily. But I liked that it's in there because I believe Cersei when she says that at least her emotions – you know, and like Lena Headey like cried a little bit in this scene, and I believe her emotions are true. Like yes, she tried to poison Tommen at the Battle of Blackwater, but I really do believe that like – she might be the world's most dysfunctional mother, but she cares very fiercely about her children and is doing what she thinks she needs to do to protect them. So,
right. Another way of saying that is doing what she needs to do to keep herself in power because she thinks she can have the most influence over him.
I mean, that's also true, but I don't know. Maybe it's naive of me to say that, like, I think it's not just that she wants to be the regent in control of him. It's that, you know, if he becomes a pawn of the Tyrells, he's not as safe as if he were her pawn, I think. But, you know, we...
I don't know. I don't agree with that, although I guess I'm assuming she's not as delusional as you think she is, which is a dangerous assumption for me to have. So she's like, okay, I'll talk to the High Sparrow. Everything's going to be okay. And then we have a scene with Littlefinger and Elena where... It's revealed – okay, so a few things are revealed in this. So much stuff happens in this episode. it's revealed that like I think it was like heavily implied, but I don't know that it was explicitly confirmed that Littlefinger and Elena worked together to kill Joffrey. Is this the first like official confirmation? I know like they definitely heavily implied it, but did they actually say it out loud like this?
I mean, Elena said to Margaery, like, do you think I'd let you marry that psychopath?
Yeah.
There was a whole like finger. I'm pretty sure that it was stated. Yeah. Like, I don't think when Littlefinger confessed his role to Sansa, I don't think he named Elena
right.
as his accomplice. But when Elena like basically told Margaery, I did this, then we know that she's Littlefinger's accomplice.
Yeah. Well, there's also the question of like, was there anyone else involved? And this scene seems to imply that that's not the case. But apparently Cersei called Littlefinger back so that he could, bring out Olivar to testify against Marjorie.
Which I believe is pretty much what I said.
Right.
But your mileage may vary. That was my thought, is that like he's Littlefinger's employee and a star witness in this trial against Loras. So
okay, well that makes sense, Joanna. But riddle me this, like she, you know, they said, okay, well we need another young dude to help us out. And that's Lancel. But what was the step between, you know, that conversation at the brothel and, you know, the scene where Lancel's like implicates Cersei? Like, couldn't Lancel have implicated Cersei anyway? Like, what did Olenna / Littlefinger say to Lancel to get into like, you know what I mean? Like,
I think Lancel was like right at the breaking point anyway, and they are mental chess masters. and could just like lean on him.
And in a completely like unseen scene in the episode.
Yeah.
Like off screen, basically.
Yeah.
Off
camera. Just be like, don't you want to come clean? Don't you? Isn't this weighing heavy on your conscience? Yeah. Sort of thing.
Yeah. Kind of a stretch, Joanna. Kind of a stretch.
I don't think so. I will say that I think it's a problem with this adaptation that Lancel's been sitting around like a ticking time bomb this whole season.
Right. Yeah. It would be one thing if he hadn't been in the season at all, and then, they activated him.
But
for
this
episode, right?
I don't think they trusted the viewers would remember who he was if they didn't, like, all season say, like, "Miss Lancel, remember? He knows shit. He slept with Cersei, killed the king," like, all this sort of stuff.
I think it would have been way more, like, impactful if they saved him, yeah.
I agree completely. Like, if we hadn't seen Lancel at all, in the books what happens is Cersei's sleeping with some other random guy. And she gets him to lie and say he was sleeping with Marjorie. And then the High Sparrow tortures him. And he says, "No, I wasn't sleeping with Marjorie." Like, that's why Marjorie's in jail, right? For adultery. Yeah. He's like, "No, I wasn't sleeping with Marjorie. I was sleeping with Cersei. And by the way, she had a bunch of people killed. I'm spilling all the beans." You know, so Lancel isn't even involved. But, and also the books are from Cersei's point of view. So you're kind of in her delusion. I think all season people watching Cersei do this have been like, this is the stupidest move she could make. She has all these own sins waiting to be exposed. Why would she give so much power to the sparrows? It's going to come back and bite her. I think a lot of people saw this coming. Whereas I think in the books is a bit more of a shock. Maybe not necessarily this exact scene coming, but I got a lot of emails from listeners being like, isn't this going to bite Cersei soon?
Yeah. Like I said last week, she got too high off her own supply.
Yeah.
Like she thought that she was as big of a deal. She acted like she was as big of a deal as she thought she was, and it burned her, you know? So anyway.
She was trying to be Tywin, and she's not Tywin. So.
Great scene with Cersei and Marjorie. Like, oh my God, it's like such a shock to see Marjorie in that state, because every time we've seen her, she's always been incredibly well put together physically, from a fashion standpoint, you know, like. From an emotional standpoint, and like all that stuff was taken from her, you know? So it was just like staggering to see her in this condition. And it's great, the contrast between like, you know, last episode and this episode, for instance.
And I don't know if this is what they were going for with – probably not. I'm probably like reaching too far. But, you know, Cersei brings in the venison and whatever. And
she's like, I ate it last night. And like,
yeah, which was great. She's just like, I had it just last night. But it's that whole sort of butcher and the meat thing. You know, like Cersei thinks she's the butcher in the situation, but she's the meat along with Marjorie. Like, she's not above getting cut down by the sparrows. So, yeah.
So she's like, hey, her accommodations are sufficient, not knowing that, like, she would soon be –
yeah.
If Cersei had said, hey, these combinations are horrible, you need to improve them, maybe she could have improved her own condition.
Maybe.
You know? And then Jonathan Pryce has this amazing monologue about the sept and vanity and, you know, stripping away your garments and, like, what remains afterwards, which I just thought was perfect.
What will we find when we strip away your finery? A young man came to us not long ago, broken in body and spirit. He had so much to strip away, so much weighing him down. But piece by piece, he unburdened himself, let go of vanity, pride, sin. Now his soul is so light, he will float through the seven heavens like a bird. And he has much to say about you.
And so, yeah, any thoughts? And, like, Cersei, like, can't believe what's happening to her. And she has a great line about, like, this is the last face you'll see before you die, which, by the way, is empirically not true. Those people are still around each other and alive. But, yeah, what did you think of... What do you think of this whole sequence of events, how it played out?
You know, other than that, I think, you know, too obvious Lancel problem, you know, the performances are amazing. I think Lena Headey is amazing, and I think Jonathan Pryce is just perfect. Perfection.
Yeah. This is a fantastic ending to this episode.
And I mean, you know, people have been waiting seasons for Cersei to,
oh,
you know,
so satisfying.
Get hers. So,
so yeah. Satisfying. Years.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I think that's everything.
That's a lot.
I'm exhausted.
I know.
Overall thoughts on this episode? I thought it was a great episode. Like, overall, I really enjoyed it. So much was happening, and just had a great time with it. Any other thoughts?
I think my review is not quite as glowing, but there's a lot that I did like, and I'm excited to see where we go from here.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. You can find us at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Find me this Friday and Saturday at the Seattle International Film Festival. Buy tickets to my movie, The Primary Instinct, at SIFT.net. How about you, Jonah Robinson?
You can find me most days on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and you can hear me talking about spoilers and speculations on a Storm Spoilers podcast.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week. Only 3 episodes remain.